Yeah, they got a good team.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the first interim committee meeting of the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's Tuesday, the 17th of September. Our first item is an organizational meeting, which I'll open on the adoption of committee rules. The committee rules have been distributed electronically. They're the same as the ones you have seen in other places. So we'd be open, if there is not any discussion about that, we'd be open for a motion to approve the rules.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the rules as presented.
Thank you. Representative Cameron has moved that the committee adopt the interim rules as presented. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any objections? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. Thank you. I'm going to close the organizational meeting and open an informational meeting on transportation project status update. We're going to hear from ODOT. Paul, come on up, about what has happened since we were last together around the state. And we have a number of people here from ODOT, so I'll let you get started.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mapper, Highway Division Administrator. I'm going to run through fairly quickly a few highlights of some of the work that ODOT staff and contractors have been working on this summer. Many of us have been on maybe vacation the last month or so, and there's contractors and workers have been working very hard on road projects around the state. So I thought I'd give you a quick update on that, and then we're going to transition into some of the revenue discussions, revenue on the state's side of ledger as well as the federal side of ledger, and we'll walk through some of the dynamics that are happening on that side. What I did want to mention that is not part of the formal presentation I have here is, I think, an obvious discussion about the Columbia River Crossing project. I have not included that in here. We've been busy answering questions from the state treasurer, from the governor's office, from legislative leadership, putting a lot of effort into answering those questions. If the chair wishes to engage in a conversation, I would ask that we maybe save that till the end of our discussion, and we can kind of get into that a little bit more at the chair's discretion.
That's great. So, thank you.
At least that's the way of approaching this. So just quickly, again, going through some of the highlights of some of the projects around the state, starting with the Sunrise Corridor project. This is on Highway 212, I-205, Milwaukee Expressway area, Clackamas, if you're familiar with that area. A very important economic hub, not only for the Portland metro area, but for the state. A large industrial area, serves many distribution centers, including Safeway, Fred Meyer's, other important industries for the state. What I have here is a little more detailed diagram, maybe I shared with you last time, showing kind of the main road of the extension, or the Sunrise Corridor that goes through the center of the diagram there, but it's supported by much of the local circulation projects or improvements on the local road network that's going to support this, ultimately support the project. The total cost of the project is about $130 million, $100 million of that comes from the Jobs and Transportation Act. The contractor on this particular contract is Kerr Construction out of Woodburn, Oregon. Here's some of the work that they're doing to build the new 82nd Drive overcrossing on 205. So if you're driving on 205, you might see some of that work that's actually going on. Turning over to the Newburgh-Dundee project, this is a large project that we have to address a very significant congestion issues for the community of Dundee and Newburgh. Well, what's funded here is about a $250 million project to bypass the communities, specifically of Newburgh and Dundee. Just short of $200 million of that comes from the Jobs and Transportation Act. This project we've divided up into four different contracts, just for a couple objectives. One, to get work started as soon as possible, but also to bring the contract size down to a level that Oregon contractors can compete for the work. And so we have one of the smaller contractors actually out there working now. The Duke Contractors out of Talent, Oregon, is the contractor. Two of the other phases are set to go sometime next year. You'll see some more significant work that's happening. We're expecting this project to be open to traffic in about 2016. Here's some of the work that the contractor's been doing this summer, a lot of the drainage, kind of the sub work that's been going on. One of the key things in a lot of our projects is drainage. This is one where we're actually putting some WIC drains in to kind of dewater or consolidate the soil so it becomes stronger without the water in it before we actually put the roadbed over the top. Woodburn Interchange is another significant project from a congestion standpoint. Maybe you experience the Woodburn Interchange and the congestion that happens there on a daily basis. This has been a project the community has wanted for some time. We had a groundbreaking ceremony for this project a few months back to begin work. You'll see in the diagram there how we've kind of divided the work up into three and then some little finish work up into four, but essentially a three-year project. It'll be a very challenging construction project given the congestion levels that are there already today, and now introducing a major construction reconstruction project in the middle that will create some challenges for us in the community. But we've been having good communication dialogue back and forth to inform people of what's going on and do what we can to mitigate that impact. This project total cost, make sure I got the right number here, is about $80 million total cost for the project. $53 million of that comes from the Jobs and Transportation Act. K&E Construction out of Salem is the contractor for this project. And again, we anticipate opening traffic by 2015, even though some of the work will extend into 2016.
Just a moment. Have a question, Representative Gorsuch?
If you could go back to that last slide for just a sec. Okay. So one of the pieces there looks like you're adding on-ramps so that you don't have cross traffic coming across to get on the freeway. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, that's correct. One of the key congestion points is those left turns that happen at the ramp terminals. And so putting those loop ramps in, we're able to do away with much of the left turns and improve the efficiencies of the interchange.
Okay. Thank you.
Very observant, Representative Gorsuch. Well done.
There's a picture of the groundbreaking ceremony we had earlier this year. It's actually the groundbreaking ceremony happened on the site of what's going to be the new transit center, which is a significant component of the project. It'll be a place where some of the regional transit providers will be able to connect with more of the local, provide a park and ride. It'll be a pretty valuable asset for the community. This is a shot of some of the other interchange work that's already begun to provide those loop ramps and do some of those improvements at the interchange itself. The OTA3 bridge program is one that we've been working on since the legislature approved that legislation back in 2003 for 10 years now. We've addressed over 300 bridges, a $1.3 billion program that has come in under budget and on time. And this project here in Eugene, where we've rebuilt the bridges over the Willamette I-5, is really the signature project of that entire program. This project alone is a $200 million project that presented many challenges for us in meeting the needs of the community as well as the needs of the traffic going across I-5, but it's been a very successful project for us and frankly has provided us ways to interact with the community in more positive ways than we have in the past and really built some relationships that we're going to need to solve some of the transportation problems in the future. This project was built by Hamilton Construction out of Springfield, Oregon. Again, it was about $200 million project. We opened it to traffic this summer. We had a couple different ceremonies, one kind of for the dignitaries and did a formal ribbon-cutting ceremony, but we also took a day out of the weekend before we opened to traffic and just allowed the community to go up and enjoy the bridge, ride their bikes, be up on the bridge, enjoy the views from the bridge, and some of the artwork that we've done in conjunction with the bridge. It's a very successful...
Can we guess which picture was which of those two?
I'm hoping it's fairly obvious. So it's very successful for the community, and it's a project that we're very proud of and part of a program that we're very, very proud of that we've been able to accomplish.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nathan.
I would like to underscore how much I know of what the community is thinking about this, how much they appreciate the work of the department and what's been happening. I like to point out when I speak publicly about that, not only under budget and a little bit ahead of time, an example of reducing environmental impact, there were 10 piers in the water, now there are only 4. New construction techniques were developed to minimize disturbing fish and habitat. the natural area was not so natural, and this project left things better than the way they had been previously. The community is just extremely appreciative of, basically, this wasn't just a highway project, it was also a park project, and the community ends up with a double benefit. It was quite incredible to watch that unfold.
I'm glad to see the lighter-hearted version as well of the opening. That's great. Thank you.
Thank you for the comments, too. Yes. So moving just staying in the Eugene-Springfield area, another project that I've talked to the committee about before is the Beltline I-5 project. What we're working on now is what we call Unit 3. It's about a $30 million project that improves the on-off ramps there in the northwest quadrant of the interchange, as well as provide a better bike facility connection through the interchange. This particular project is also, it's a $30 million project. The contractor on this project is K&E out of Salem. It's really aimed to address the growth that's happening in the Springfield side or the east side of this interchange, the hospital improvements, as well as some of the growth that's been happening in that gateway area is really needed. This interchange is needed to support that growth. Here's an aerial shot earlier this summer of some of the improvements. You can start to see, if you kind of use your imagination there in the lower left, how the new off-ramp is starting to take form there on the very left side with the fill and matching into some of the new pavement you see there more towards the center. That'll be the new configuration of the on and off-ramp and the elimination of that loop ramp and some of that weaving, if you're familiar, going just traveling through on the main I-5, some of the problems with the weaving area that will be eliminated with this project. Another shot of that loop ramp. Another important project for us, and again, another JTA project that is in Southern Oregon. This is a climbing lane on I-5 just north of Grants Pass. For efficiencies, we've been able to incorporate this Jobs and Transportation Act project, about a $10 million climbing lane, in with a normal paving project we had. So the total project cost is about $40 million, where we're repaving this entire section of freeway and gain some efficiencies by combining that. The contractor in this project is Knife River out of their Medford office in delivering this project. Really needed for safety. If any of you have traveled those climbing lanes, trucks travel in some cases 5, maybe 10 miles an hour going up, and you have traffic going 65, sometimes faster than that, and that speed differential really causes some safety issues for us. It's going to address that as well as just make driving over this pass much more enjoyable and not having to deal with that congestion. One of the sad notes on this project, if you remember during last session, Brian Gray from Knife River was here talking about work zone issues and some of the safety things he has observed and talking about some of the things we can do. Knife River actually had one of those employees killed on this project this summer. What appears to be a distracted driver hit a piece of equipment, moving that equipment over beyond a guardrail and striking an employee that was behind the guardrail. So it was an unfortunate incident, but it just reminds us how dangerous our work zones are and how diligent we need to be when we're in those work zones. So maybe a future conversation we may come back to you with is some ideas we may have to improve the safety of our work zones. Final project also is a climbing lane project. This is a major project, again, where we've combined a Jobs and Transportation Act climbing lane project with a significant maintenance-type project where we're rehabilitating the pavements and the bridges in this section and combining that for efficiencies with a sorely needed climbing lane project just out of the grant. Again, the total project cost for this project is about $40 million, of which the Jobs and Transportation Act makes up about $5 million. Oregon Main Line is the contractor on this project. This will be a multiple-year project just because of the complexities and the limited work windows in the summertime that we get to work with in this area. But I know Representative Benz, as you drive this area, you'll be able to keep track of many of our progress as we work on this project. Here's some of the congestion that we see in the wintertime as we deal with chain up and large volume of truck traffic. The climbing lane will help, again, like in the Sexton project, help sort that out for traffic, but also providing some chain up areas will make this safer as well, more efficient to use. So with that, let's transition into some discussions about just where we are with revenue projections.
Any other questions on project updates before we transition? Go ahead, please.
Good. So with me is Dave Cavanaugh, our ODOT's economist, and he's just going to quickly walk you through on the state side, followed by Travis Brower, who will cover a little bit the federal side of the equation.
Chair Reed and members of the Interim House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Dave Cavanaugh, State Transportation Economist at the Oregon Department of Transportation. The first slide covers what we refer to as the other funds revenue forecast. These relate to revenues that are strictly generated by fees and taxes that are charged within the state. It excludes federal resources or federal funds, but that's a topic that my colleague, Mr. Brower, will go ahead and talk about after my presentation. Gross revenues run at about $2.3 to $2.4 billion per biennium. But to really get an idea of the resource base that's available to the agency to go ahead and maintain and repair and enhance the state highway network, we have to strip out certain components. Now, the first major component is in the lower right-hand portion of the chart, collection costs and transfers. These are collection costs to actually collect the revenues, interagency transfers, intra-agency transfers that are dedicated programs. That's about 17% of the $2.3 billion. After those transfers and costs are taken out, then we go ahead and apply the apportionment formulas that distribute the funds to our local stakeholder government entities.
And could you remind us, just before you go any further, of a couple of examples of those transfers in that first percentage, just so we orient ourselves?
Yeah, Chairman Reed, an example would be ATV use of gasoline is an off-road use, so constitutionally that can't go into the state highway fund. ATV users still pay the tax at the pump, and so we go ahead and we work with Parks and Recreation to calculate what the off-road gallon consumption is and transfer those monies to Parks and Recreation for their programs.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, once we do that, then we apply the apportionment formulas, and that amounts to a fair amount, about 33% of the total $2.3 billion. And what's left, about 50%, is what's available net to the State Highway Fund. Currently, we have a debt service on the order of about $380 million at a biennium run rate, so that leaves about $770 million left as more of a discretionary resource. So the amount that's available to the agency is about $1.2 billion, or slightly more than half of the total gross revenue collections. What are the assumptions in the forecast? This is based on the state's economic forecast, June 2013, which is known as the May close of session 2013 forecast. It also uses exactly the same macroeconomic forecast that drives the state forecast, so we're very closely joined at the hip with what the state is forecasting for the economy and general fund revenues. What are the sources of the revenues? There are two ways of representing these. One on the left, by source. You can see the motor fuels taxes are nearly half of all the revenues that are collected. These relate to gas taxes that are paid and diesel fuel taxes that are paid by passenger vehicles and all other vehicles up to a gross vehicle weight of 26,000 pounds. Going in clockwise fashion, weight mile taxes represent the taxes paid by trucks in excess of 26,000 pounds. They pay by the distance that they drive, and also by weight, and also by the axle configuration that their tractor trailer is configured according to. The next major component are the vehicle license fees. These are passenger vehicle registration fees, as well as registration payments by the heavy truck, the trucking industry, if you will, and also items such as trailer registrations fall into that category, about 20% of the gross revenues. Other transportation license fees amount to almost 10% of the collections. These relate primarily to title transactions. These would be title transactions for new car purchases, title transfers for used cars or secondary market transactions, and also cars that come into the state from in-migration. Those people want an Oregon title that they would come in and get an Oregon title. And there are also some duplicate title transactions where people lose their duplicates and they go through and get a duplicate made. The final component, about 3%, are driver's license fees. These are both for commercial driver's licenses and associated tests that they have to take, as well as for Class A driver's licenses for individuals. Another way of classifying revenues is by type, and this basically tries to get at how the costs are imposed or how the travel demands are imposed on the state highway network. User taxes, which are gasoline taxes, fuel taxes, if you will, and the weight mile tax, those are taxes that vary by how intensively the system is used. People drive more on the network, they consume more gasoline, they pay more gas tax. So the usage on the system is captured by the user taxes. The vehicle and driver and other fees, that's basically kind of an access charge. For example, a driver's license gives the driver the legal presence or privilege of a legal presence to access the highway network, but the fee or the revenues that are generated from this doesn't depend on how intensively the system is used. Whether they go out one time or not, they still pay that fixed fee. It's kind of like an access charge. What is our general revenue outlook? The next slide gives a very high altitude overview of what the revenue picture looks like. The first line, the red one, is our current June 2013 projection. Basically, it shows after the complete phase-in of the JTA revenues in 2010 and 2011, the revenues are growing at slightly more than 2% per year, about 2.1% per year. The effects of JTA are revealed in the somewhat more steep acceleration or ramp up, if you will, in the red line. But there, it's pretty well been phased in and complete by 2012. So we go back to kind of our longer run growth pattern. Two major other takeaways from this are we've gone ahead and juxtaposed our best forecast as of 2009, summer of 2009, the first forecast that was done after the JTA legislation in the 2009 session. And it's pretty obvious that there's been a considerable erosion in what we thought the world looked like at that time, as well as going forward from where we are 3 years later. In fact, the erosion is fairly significant. Cumulatively, over the five-year period, it's about $508 million short of where we thought we would be in revenue collection in gross terms in 2009. So that's fairly significant. Major culprit to that, the economy as recovery was very tepid, and moreover, the timing of the rebound of the recovery has always been kind of deferred and pushed out. So if we had known what we know about the economy in 2009, that blue line would be almost identical to where the red line is. But that just shows what the difficulty is in forecasting the macro and the state environment.
Dr. Cavanaugh, three of us, of course, are on the revenue committee as well, so we're used to some of these projections. Do you end up adjusting your projections on that same calendar? You mentioned that you rely much as the state economist does on IHS, I assume. Do you make quarterly adjustments as well?
Chairman Reed, we're pretty careful to not want to make adjustments because that becomes a little bit more judgmental and somewhat arbitrary. We'd like to let the data kind of speak for itself. We update the data in the model every 6 months, reestimate all the coefficients and parameters of the model to reflect the most current data that we have, and then we'll look to see how the model does. If the model misses a little bit by one quarter or if it misses for two consecutive quarters, we generally say, well, these models are known to revert to the mean. They'll go back to the way things were. You know, that's not always the case, but generally that's a pretty good bet if the model is highly statistically significant. So we don't do too many adjustments. If it misses for five or six quarters systematically on one side or another, then we'll look at it and say, well, we need to recalibrate, impose a little bit of judgment on the forecast. But I would say generally we only do that maybe one out of five or six times. We let the data go ahead and drive the forecast.
And are there things about the way that the global and maybe national trends interact with highway fund projections that are different than one might expect in a more global sense? We're down in the revenue committee. We have ideas about how something happening in the world might affect Oregon. Does that generally hold when it's in the transportation world, or are there places where it's what we might not expect?
Chairman Reed and members of the committee, it's a little more muted, to be real short, but we do have those influences in there because basically the world price of crude oil, of which there are many different prices depending on the regions in the world where the oil is being, where the crude is coming from, does filter into the model in terms of fuel prices. But generally, transportation revenues are a little bit more stable than the state economy is. The state economy is joined very closely to what goes on nationally. We're just big enough in Oregon in relation to the national economy that we can feel the and measure and detect the linkages. But when it comes to transportation, it's a little bit muted, with the exception that this last great recession that we went through, transportation revenues really got knocked very hard, not unlike what we saw in the total non-farm employment numbers for the state. So when the recession's real bad, transportation revenues are a little bit more sensitive, but ordinarily, when you have a recession, transportation revenues are somewhat more stable. And that's partly an outgrowth of the demographics that drive the transportation revenues, the fees and things. Age cohorts that come in into driving age, they go ahead and they get their driver's permit, they get their driver's license. Well, when it comes to demographics, that changes very slowly. So that's kind of a softening or a balancing element to our revenue forecast. So it's generally less capricious.
Thank you. Representative Benson, just before we get started, sorry, Dr. Carroll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed there's a break in the line there at about slightly before 2012, maybe into 2012. What was that? Was that directly tied to an increase in gas prices? Is that what that is? Or could you? Does your model explain why that sudden
Why, Chairman, or Co-Chairman Benz and members of the committee, why it flattens out in the 2012?
Yeah, exactly.
It's an outgrowth of two things. Not so much fuel prices, because we went through the fuel price shock, as you recall, in the first half and summer of 2008. So consumers are getting a little bit used to higher prices, and so the price impacts are a little bit more muted. But basically what we had was just a slowdown in travel demands in the 2011-2000 time frame. We were coming back pretty strongly in early 2010, coupled with also the revenue enhancements from JTA. Well, by that time, the revenue enhancements from JTA had fully been implemented and kicked in, and so we weren't getting a boost from those increases in fees and taxes, but we were being pulled down by rather substandard job growth in that time frame.
So the question, I guess, is this: that seems to be quite a change. Is that change in your projection normal? Is this a reflection of something that's not just because the model was off a bit, but a true change in driving habits?
Co-Chairman Benz, members of the committee, it's largely driven by total non-farm employment and Oregon disposable income, personal income in the state as an aggregate amount. You know, we all know that on a per capita basis, wages and salaries haven't been very robust. But it's basically a substandard growth in that until we get into the 2015 time frame, where our total non-farm employment gets up above peak levels that were accomplished in 2007, which is an eight-year period for the job recovery to take place. The second thing is, in answer to your question, specifically, 2012 was a soft year. And so the question that the Chairman Reed asked about adjustments and things, we didn't adjust the 2013-2014 to reflect necessarily the softness that we saw in 2012. So the models would have a tendency to forecast a slight rebound. And finally, in answer to your question about shifts or structural changes and things like that, the way we run the model, we generally let the data determine whether there's been a significant structural shift or not. And with the data evolving on a quarterly basis, we would probably have to wait another 3 or 4 years for those effects to really register in a way that we could say, oh, it's really right here in front of us, and it's being captured in the model in terms of less sensitivity to total non-farm job levels, less sensitivity to aggregate real income. But right now, those shifts are still in their nascent stages at this point.
Go ahead.
So the downward trend then is a reflection of economic difficulties, if you will.
By and large.
Okay, not a substantial change in driving habits.
Right.
Thank you, guys.
Well, the second and final takeaway is that these numbers are nominal numbers. They're not adjusted for construction and maintenance inflation, which is running at about 2% a year. So if you have 2% nominal growth and 2% cost escalation, that means everything is flat. And so the agency, in terms of its discretionary resources, is basically just keeping its head above water. That's better than having to go underwater, but it still means that we're not making any headway into meeting increasing travel demands that are being placed on the state highway network. What does the current forecast indicate for our capacity to service our indebtedness? The next chart is the final chart. Shows basically the amount of money that's available net to the agency. It's the $1.2 billion for the 2013-2015 time frame. The debt service is about $360 million. The surplus over that is about $800 million for about $1.2 billion. Net revenues are still growing at about 2% in the nominal terms. Debt service increases in 2013 biennium and the 2015 biennium because we're starting to issue JTA bonds as the $840 million that was authorized in the JTA legislation. But we still have on the order of 3 to 4 times the revenues on above debt service or over debt service. So that coverage ratio is a very healthy indicator of our financial condition. Our bond ratings are extremely high and very strong, and that serves to minimize our interest rate costs. So unless there are additional questions.
I don't see any. That was Representative Needs. I'm sorry.
Not a question. And I realize mostly we're talking about a very specific fund here, but I couldn't help but recall an article I had read a few weeks ago in the newspaper, and I wondered which other committee members had seen the same thing that I had. Quote, "It costs less to operate a car in Oregon than in any other state in the union, according to research released Wednesday by financial aggregator Bankrate.com. It's the lowest in the nation. I thought that was that's number 50 or number one, depending what how you want to look at it. It says the average cost of repairs, insurance, gas, taxes, and fees amounts to about $2,200 a year. The national average is $3,200. It mentions that maybe drivers are safer in Oregon. And maybe that's why insurance costs less here, lack of a sales tax, motorists drive less than in most other states. We have the lowest vehicle fees in the nation and relatively low insurance premiums. So there's something to learn out of this article, but I'm sure each one of us will take something different from that.
I think you're right, Representative Nathanson. Thank you for that observation. Any other questions or comments? Let's see. Thank you very much, Mr. Kavanaugh. Mr. Brower.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Travis Brower. I am ODOT's Federal Affairs Advisor, and today I get to present you a picture on the federal side of our revenue stream, which is also a very important part of our overall funding, particularly for capital projects that improve and preserve the transportation system. There are two words today to take away from my presentation about federal funding. It's uncertainty and risk. Both of those...
Thank you.
Gosh, that's really uplifting. Thank you.
I am known for being uplifting. In fact, within ODOT, they are now calling me the angel of death. I'm not sure I appreciate that, but it is what it is. Uncertainty and risk cloud the future at the federal level. Uncertainty about what will happen with federal surface transportation funding once MAP 21 expires in a year, and then significant risk that it will be cut substantially. You may recall that a year ago, Congress passed the Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century Surface Transportation Authorization Bill, known as MAP 21. It kept funding flat through 2014. And so the chart you see up above shows the level of funding that is provided out of the Federal Highway Trust Fund for highways and transit and safety programs. However, MAP 21 expires in 378 days and 10 hours, not that anybody's really counting. And once it expires, we run into a pretty significant situation of risk of funding cuts because, as you can see from this chart, outlays have been exceeding the amount of revenue coming into the Highway Trust Fund from user fees by a pretty substantial amount over the last 5 or 6 years, about $10 to $15 billion a year, depending on the year. As a result, the only way Congress has been able to continue funding highways, transit, and safety programs at current levels is to transfer about $54 billion in general fund revenue into the Highway Trust Fund. However, those balances, as you can see from the line, the green line marked balances, will run out in about a year, about the same time MAP 21 expires. And when that happens, Congress will be faced with some difficult choices. They need about $15 billion a year in order to keep funding at the current level. So they have essentially three general options to look at. One would be continued general fund transfers of about $15 billion a year. Another would be some increase in user fees, and at the federal level, that primarily is the fuels tax. They'd need about an 8 to 10 cent per gallon gas tax increase, or they could cut funding by about 30%. Now, none of these are really politically palatable options for Congress. I don't think any of them would receive a majority vote. However, if Congress does nothing, it would result in about a 30% cut in transportation funding. What I've been joking lately, if you can count on Congress doing one thing, it's nothing. In that sense, the future is not looking so great, and there's a lot of risk in the future. If that happens, and Paul, can you go to the next slide, please? This would show you what would happen with funding. You see, under MAP 21, funding was a little bit lower than it was in the last few years, but basically flat. Flat's good compared to the projection that we would see if Congress does nothing and provides no additional revenue, where our federal highway funding for the state would fall by about a quarter, by about $125 million a year. Under this situation, ODOT would have to cut projects from the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, or the STIP, and local governments, who get about 30% of the funding from the state's federal highway funding, would also be hit pretty hard, as you can imagine. On the transit side, I don't have a chart for this because it's a little harder to calculate, but transit, in the mass transit account, there's even a proportionally larger deficit. So transit could face cuts of 40 to 45%. That would be pretty devastating both for the major urban transit agencies that primarily use the funding for capital projects, you know, new buses, bus shelters, etc., and also for the rural providers and small town providers who primarily use that federal funding to operate their systems. So that would be a pretty substantial loss of what in the rural areas is the primary source of funding for transit. So in the long term, it appears that with the federal budget austerity, there are some pretty substantial challenges for federal highway funding.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Representative Gorsuch, please.
So we've been talking about CRC, and maybe we'll talk more about CRC. How would those potential problems affect the current promised level of funding for the CRC project, or would it?
Mm-hmm. Chair Reed, Representative Gorsuch, the amount of funding we receive each year from the currently from the Federal Highway Trust Fund, the highway program, is a bit over $450 million, as you can see there in this chart. The amount that would be needed to bond to pay for the Columbia River crossing is now, in the adjusted finance plan, about $23 million a year. So around 5 to 6% of the amount we need of our federal highway fund. So even if federal funding were cut, there would still be opportunities to pay that debt service if the state had committed to pay that debt service from the federal funds.
Thank you.
That's about all I had. Just to note that in general, in the long term, I think it's pretty safe to say that federal funding is not likely to go up given the challenges in the Highway Trust Fund and this upcoming fiscal cliff we face, and that in a good case scenario is flat funding into the future, perhaps just as likely as that we'll see declining federal transportation funding, and certainly not, we can't count on robust levels of federal investment in the future and may have to look less to the federal government for investment in surface transportation.
That's really consistent with some of the message I heard at the OTREC conference yesterday, that notion that the federal government's role is, to use your word, uncertain, and putting more of a burden on individual states to come up with their own solutions. Any other questions for Mr. Breyer, Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Travis, is that you brought the previous slide, if you could go back to it, down to 350 billion. What's can you say again why you selected that level?
Chair Reed, Vice Chair Benz, this reflects approximately a 25% cut in federal highway funding, which is essentially what level you would see if the Highway Trust Fund has to rely solely on the user fee revenue that is coming in and cannot, there are no future transfers of general fund revenue into the Highway Trust Fund. Currently, user fee revenue is about 75% of the level of funding that Congress has approved. So if you get rid of the transfers, you lop off about 25% of the revenue that's available.
And so we have roughly $450 million a year coming in. Would that result in a 25% decrease in that number?
Chair Reed, Representative Bench, yes, it's about a 25% reduction from that level, of current level of funding.
I guess I just want to make sure there's a direct correlation between that reduction and the impact here in Oregon. There's no odd adjustment someplace that would have a greater or lesser impact on Oregon as a result of that line actually reducing.
Yeah, Chair Reed, Representative Bence, you know, Congress could choose different ways of applying that cut. However, generally what they do is each state gets a defined share of the federal aid highway funding. Ours is 1.21% or thereabouts. Actually went up a little bit in MAP 21, so that was a good thing. But in general, they just would apply, we would expect that cut across the board, and thus there'd be no real difference.
So that prompts a question for me. If you're finished, why did our share go up? Are there things we should be doing and thinking about to maximize our share in the unlikely event that Congress gets it together and does something smart?
Chair Reed, yes, that we are at ODOT. We're currently always thinking about how we can maximize our share of federal funding, whether it's going after discretionary grants or ensuring that we play in determining how those formulas are written to maximize Oregon's share. I could walk you through why it went up, but let's just say it's kind of down in the weeds. And suffice to say, we got very lucky. It's worth about $24 million a year for Oregon. It's 0.07% change in our share is worth about $24 million a year. So in that sense, little tiny changes are worth a lot, and we're always working with our congressional delegation to maximize that.
That makes sense. Are there things that we should be doing as a legislature to increase your capacity to be successful at that effort?
Chair Reed, generally what I tell people is the federal government helps those who help themselves. And so in general, to the extent that the state has provided, the legislature has provided funding for programs like the Jobs and Transportation Act, for example, having that money and having those projects move forward allowed us to go for federal grants for a number of projects. For example, the Woodburn Interchange was one where we were able to secure some additional federal funding. It wasn't enough to cover the entire gap in the original finance plan, but we were able to get a few million dollars to supplement that program from those federal discretionary pots of money. So certainly the legislature stepping up has always been very helpful in that regard.
Thank you. There aren't other questions or comments. Sounds like we're going to sort of make a transition, having a basic understanding of where we are now, maybe to where we're headed.
Yes, I'm just going to give you just a quick brief, trying to tie these three presentations together, and I'm going to use as a visual aid just this mountain graph that you've seen before. It looks backwards and forwards at our funding and calls out specifically programs the legislature largely have enacted in the OTA 1, 2, 3, Jobs and Transportation Act, Connect Oregon. Many of those projects funded by those programs are ones that I talked about in our in my presentation. Many of those are one-time money that we've used to bond and pay off in the future. As you heard Mr. Kavanaugh's presentation, much of his presentation was on the state side, the state funded. The state funds we use to run transportation in Oregon. So it's used for maintenance costs, it's used for everyday operation of the transportation system. Our federal funds can only be used for those capital projects. And so that blue line down to the STIP, which we're going to be talking about here more in a second, is really what Travis talked about. And those are our kind of bread and butter projects that you see out there, repairing bridges, fixing pavements, fixing culverts, and doing some limited amount of enhancement to the system is in that. So when Travis talks about those reductions, those are the type of projects that you would see less of. When Mr. Kavanaugh talks about the reduction in state, Those are when it gets to our maintenance forces. We have to do reductions in maintenance or reductions in DMV or reductions elsewhere in the department. So just in a big picture, you kind of see those, kind of, at least I see those three kind of big funding pictures of the operation on the state side, the capital construction projects on the federal side, and then the one-time bonded programs that have come out of the legislature over the last, largely out of the legislature over the last 10 years. You know, what that does, you know, looking forward, we have many affectionate names for Mr. Brower in our department, but as you look at some of the some of the charts, you see why we get to some of those. When we look at our bridges looking out in the future, as those federal funds go down, it has a direct impact on the condition of our system because we rely on those federal funds to keep the condition of our system where it's at. Likewise on the pavements, in a little shorter time period, but we also see impacts just in that overall condition of our system, and that's the impact of those federal funds going down. And these charts anticipate some of those reductions that Travis talked about. So hopefully that kind of brings things together a little bit on the funding side.
It does. Thank you. Next question. So now we're going to hear from some of the regions about some of the project selection and so on.
Yeah, so if we could, we could transition here. I wanted to do, if I can get out of this.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay. For that, I did it. So one of the things, we've got a few folks here that I'd really like you to spend some time with. I'm going to just give a brief introduction because I think you need to spend most of your time talking to some of the representatives of various commissions on transportation around the state and having them share with you the processes that they go to select projects. But one of the things usually during session we don't have time really to talk about or really explain is how we go about selecting projects. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time today talking about that selection process and how ODOT and our commission do that. First of all, our Transportation Commission is the one that's authorized to select projects. And we put a document together. It's the STIP, Statewide Transportation Improvement Program. This is a federal document that is approved by our commission, but is also a federally approved document that contains every federally funded project in the state. As we go through and put this together, obviously the Oregon Transportation Plan, again a product of our commission, sets those policies that we use to select those projects in there. One of the important pieces in the OTP or the Oregon Transportation Plan is that our commission puts priority on maintaining what we have before we expand what we have. And so when we look at the amount of funding that we have to put towards enhancing, put towards enhancing our system, one of the things we focus on first is just those basic maintenance of bridge and preservation of our programs and using our various management systems to select those projects. But really what I wanted to get to today is about 25% of those federally funds that come towards the STIP, our commission has designated towards projects that enhance our system. And we want to talk a little bit about how we use citizens throughout Oregon to select those projects, and really something that has become a very key part of our process, and those are our local area commissions on transportation from around the state. What I have here is a map that shows those various area commissions on transportation around the state. You'll notice we have those in every part of the state except one, in the Portland metro area. And that was part of our conversation we had in the previous session from Representative Kennemer about how do we represent the Portland metro area and some of those county rural areas around that. And we've been doing the follow-up work with Clackamas County, with Metro, and with ODOT to come up with a solution to fill in that part of the map, so to speak, to make sure we have representation in our project selection process from around the state. The acts were first created in 1996. We had the first one here in the Salem Mid Valley area and one down in the Rogue Valley were our first two that were created. Each one of them have a charter from the commission. Again, the commission has the authority to select the projects, but they use these advisory committees in the area commission to inform their decision, and they have a charter that's with them. One of the important aspects of that charter is the diversity of membership that is around the table in selecting those. Not only do local governments, every local government has a seat table, we have tribes, we have transit districts, and we have general citizens, business representatives. So it's a very diverse group bringing many different points of view together, which we believe gives us a very good product in supporting projects. So back to the mountain chart. We use this graph a lot, but really to kind of hone in on exactly where in the funding piece that we're talking about when we talk about selecting projects. It's down in that blue piece. It's down in the STIP. And the commission puts emphasis on kind of fixing the system or keeping it enhanced. So that's the 76% of the money goes towards just keeping the system functional, where they have made a policy decision to put about 24% of the funds, or for the current update that we're going through, and you're going to hear about from the three members here just in a second, is about $227 million over a three-year period goes towards projects of all different shapes and sizes towards enhancing the system. Typically, these are not because of the size of money. Obviously, it's not the big projects that I went through just a few minutes ago. These are the bike paths, the sidewalks, the turn lanes, the traffic signals, those type of projects that can be equally important to for a lot of communities. Just quickly on the process, we've made some adjustments to our process recently in trying to really kind of multimodalize our decision-making process. We don't focus just on highway projects in a silo, but take those needs around the highway side as well as transit and bike ped and other modes. Ask the transportation agencies to make application to the Area Commission for those projects. The Area Commissions have gone through and prioritized those down to their, what we call their 150% list. So it's a little more than their allocation, but kind of get a starting point for the conversation. We go through and scope those projects, get input on those projects, and currently, right now, they're going through and prioritizing those down to the exact amount of money they have. So that application process started last year, and the current process we're in started last year in November. The Area Commission went through and prioritized those down to 150% list. We had input from the statewide committees, the Freight Committee, the Bike Ped Committee at a statewide level gave feedback to the Area Commissions. The Transportation Commission gave feedback to them, and now the acts, literally as we speak, are going through and making those final recommendations, which will go to our commission to form the draft STIP, go out for public review, get comments. Ultimately, the document that I held up earlier will be approved in November of 14. So just briefly, that's kind of the guts of it. But what I wanted to do is really have you spend some time talking to some of the members of the Area Commission. Sitting immediately on my right is Martin Callery. He is the chair of the Southwest Area Commission on Transportation, but sits in a pretty unique position in that he serves also on the Lane Area Commission on Transportation. So he has experience actually with two. He chairs one involved in another. To his right is Ken Woods. He's a businessman from Dallas. He chairs the Mid-Willamette Valley Act. And on his right is Mike Hayward. He's the chair of the Wallowa County Commission and serves on the Northeast Act. So it gives you kind of a broad range of experiences on the different acts around the state, and I'll allow them just to say a few comments about their experience in working on the acts and what it's like kind of going through things, just how their acts operate. So, Martin, you want to get started and kind of walk through that?
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Martin Callery. I'm here representing the Southwest Area Commission on Transportation. I also serve as the rail stakeholder on the Lane Act. I can tell you that this particular process for the STIP has been both challenging and an education process, because we went from pretty much a total focus on the highway system in past evaluations of the process, of the STIP process, down to really having to focus on the fact that we have a multimodal system that serves all areas of the state and serves a much broader variety of users, everything from public transit to bike ped to heavy freight hauling on the highway system and everything else. I took the liberty earlier today to hand out a little thing from the city of Reedsport, and I did that because it shows the disparity between some of the projects that we have to consider. You saw earlier that there was a couple of illustrations of highway passing lanes, primarily interstate highway passing lanes. One of the challenges we faced in this particular STIP was having to look at that. It's easy for people to look at the highway system and say, yes, this is necessary. I've been on the highways. I've seen how truck traffic, when conditions get poor, how it bogs things down. To the point where if you see on the back of that little letter from the city of Reedsport, They face an issue of not having sidewalks where there is a major truck corridor. And it was just out of coincidence that the city manager went out that day and took some photographs. And in one of those photographs, you see where a gentleman in a motorized wheelchair was motoring down the side of the road, and the breeze off of the truck knocked his hat off. The next set of photographs is a woman with a double stroller moving her children. I mean, this is the disparity from having to consider what happens on the interstate highway system to what happens in a small rural community that really needs a major project. Now, I can tell you on Friday of last week, we finalized our 100% list, and both those projects were in there. It took a lot of discussion at the ACT. It's been an education because at the same time we were doing this, we were adding many representatives of the other modes, transit, bike ped, and this type of thing. So while we were considering these types of things, it's been an education for them to now understand that while in the past they applied for their own projects in a siloed manner, if it was a bike ped or if it was a transit, they knew where they went. Now it's all together in an enhanced program, and you have to really understand that you serve a system that serves them, the state. And so I'm proud to say that we went through the process. We were successful. It had its challenges, but I think we laid some solid groundwork to make this a successful process going forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Ken Woods. I'm on the Dallas City Council. I've been there for 31 years. I'm also a charter member of MWAC, and we were the first ACT established in 1996. And for the past many years, I've been the chair of MWAC. MWAC represents Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. We are the largest populated area in Region 2. We also have the most road miles in Region 2. Most everyone has to travel through our three counties to get from I-5 to the Central Oregon coast, not to mention Spirit Mountain Casino, the number one tourist attraction in the state. MWAC is made up of 17 members, which about 9 are local elected officials. They represent their cities and counties. There's the area manager from ODOT, 2 members from transit districts, 1 from the tribal community, and 3 private sectors, each from one of the counties. MWAC is staffed by the Council of Governments. Over the years, the ACTs have been asked to prioritize various transportation improvement projects and recommended to the OTC. With the enhancement process, we were at a quandary. Do we keep working on old modernization projects or forget them and add new ones? The enhancement process is quite different from the past processes since it was to focus on the full spectrum of multimodal projects. We looked at the makeup of our membership so that the views of all modes were adequately represented. Rather than alter the Commission's membership, MWAC expanded the representation of the Technical Advisory Committee by adding local technical staff and representatives of the transit and bicycle communities. We receive applications for over 300% of our expected allocation for Region 2 available funds. The MWAC Steering Committee and the Technical Advisory Committee met in an all-day session to provide some relative rankings of the projects. The applicants were provided a short time during this process to describe their projects and answer any questions. The scored list of projects were then brought to the entire MWAC membership and the TAC for open discussion regarding the rankings. The applicants were available for questions, but no presentations were made. MWAC narrowed the original list down to an estimated 150% list so that ODOT staff could field scope the projects and provide costs that had been evaluated under the same rules. The scoping process led to some significant increases in estimated project cost. ODOT was then authorized to prepare a straw proposal of 100% list based on input from MWAC. The four ODOT area managers then prepared a draft 100% list from each of the acts in Region 2. The chair and vice chair from each of the four acts in Region 2, and we called it the Super Act, met last week to finalize the Region 2 100% list. The results: we have a broad spectrum of local jurisdictions are scheduled for projects, and we managed to provide some funding to a large planning project to keep it moving forward. The projects are primarily safety projects, sidewalk connectivity, and bike ped. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Hayward, chairman of the Wallowa County Board of Commissioners. I've been a commissioner for 17 years now, and I've been on the Northeast Area Commission on Transportation since it was started a little over 10 years ago, and currently serve as the chair. It has been a very rewarding and sometimes a bit frustrating, but overall a good process that we use on the NEACT. And if you go back to the map that was up a bit ago, you saw the NEACT and the SEACT, which those two area commissions serve Region 5 for ODOT, which is about a third of the state in terms of land mass. So it's a big area. And so our people come from quite a ways away. The NEAC serves Morrow, Umatilla, Union, Baker, and Wallowa counties. So, and the membership is county commissioners or representatives, city representatives, ports, the tribe. We have business interest on there. We also have the Forest Service shows up a lot, although they're not a member. We have congressional delegation staffers come to our meetings. And I can proudly say that in the little over 10 years we've been in existence, some people are traveling an hour and a half to get there. We've never not had a quorum in that amount of time. So it's important to the people of our area, the transportation. And the fact that I should also take the moment, I drove down here yesterday, been in Salem three out of the last 4 weeks. It's about a 6.5 hour drive. I should always thank ODOT when I get down here and didn't have any trouble, and I didn't, and I appreciate that. You know, we've had a good decision-making process in terms of Connect Oregon, and we've used that effectively. This time was a little bit different, as was pointed out. First of all, we were instructed that we needed to do a better job of including transit and bike ped on our committees. So we did that and put specific slots for those. We've always used a subcommittee process. The subcommittee looked at the applications and really got deep into them and chose the projects that for, in this case, the 100% list, or 150% list, excuse me. So we did that. The bike ped people, or the representative and the transit people, I thought did a really good job of bringing the rest of the committee along with the understanding what those needs are. The interesting thing about this process was we kind of have four goals over there. We were looking to get a mix of projects on the state system and the local jurisdictions. We're also needing a mix between the NEACT and the SEACT. We couldn't leave one side of the deal out. We were told that we should look at projects that had a statewide or at least a regional significance. And then we needed a mix of highway, bike ped, and transit projects. So those, we kind of had to weave all that into the process. And I think we did a pretty good job of that. So the challenges, a couple. We had over $70 million worth of project requests, and we had $15.6 million. So there's a lot of projects that went by the wayside, at least for this round. Big projects scared us. If you want $8 million for an interchange in Pendleton out of $15 million, it's tough to get the committee to say, yeah, we'll fund that, because it's really going to hit the other projects. And then the issue of small town projects. Is a sidewalk in Cove, where they need a couple $300,000 to do that and keep a kid safe, does that compete with the interchange in Pendleton that needs $8 million? It's not statewide significance, but it's extremely important to the people of Cove, and there's no other place for them to turn for the money. So the last thing I would close with is the keys to success. I think it's two. One, not just in this, but in everything the acts do. You've got to have dedicated ODOT staff that works with the act, provides us the information we need, and really keeps us in the loop on the process. And we are very fortunate in Region 5 to have it. The second thing you have to have is you have to have ACT members. Most of these people are from somewhere and they're tied somehow to transportation. They've got their own projects. They have to look at the region and put the region needs ahead of their own jurisdiction. Because if they don't, it won't work. So we're just about done. Thursday, heading to John Day. We'll finish our process on this, and then it's on to Connect 5. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Benz may have some advice for you if you're riding your bike to John Day. Any questions or comments for these chairmen?
Thank you.
Representative Benz.
Is the cove getting its sidewalk? That's the question.
Sidewalk.
Representative Benz, yes.
That's good.
Right. Number one on the list. Good.
Mr. Chair, I just have just one comment. I think just a takeaway for the committee. These gentlemen and the Area Commissions on Transportation are a very valuable tool for the Commission in prioritizing making some of those hard decisions that they talked about. But I just remind the committee they're also available for the legislature in your process. And I just talked to about two of the programs that are on the mountain chart. One is the Connect Oregon process. And we utilize the Area Commissions extensively in selecting those projects. The JTA process was one that was solely selected by the legislature and didn't involve the Area Commissions. Just as you talk about future funding or future projects or selecting projects, it's just a reminder, there is a great resource for you here to involve communities and gain support for projects and make some of those hard decisions you have to make, push them down to some of the locals and have them make those hard decisions that they just talked about and comparing and contrasting all those needs in those communities. So just a reminder, they're a great resource for the state, not just for the commission, but also for the legislature.
That's very helpful. Thank you, Paul. In fact, you yeah. took the words out of the question I was going to ask. I'm also pleased that when you said push the difficult decisions down to them, they didn't run away.
Yeah.
That bodes well, too. What advice would you have for us? I mean, one of the purposes of these interim meetings and hearings is obviously to prepare for and consider what might come before us in future sessions. And I have no trouble saying that I hope sooner rather than later we are going to consider and I hope pass a large transportation package. From your experiences of both a significant content and length, what advice would you have for us as we start to think about that possibility?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I think the process that we've just gone through where the ACTs have had the opportunity now to look at a system approach and understand how all of this fits together to benefit the state, I think that expertise at the local level needs to be engaged because they can get a buy-off for the breadth of the program that I'm hoping the legislature will pursue. And of course, you know, I'm involved in a lot of different transportation things, and I can tell you we need a big lift for the system. But I think pushing it down to the level of the ACT and engaging the ACTs and making sure that people understand the system approach is going to be critical to getting that through. Because in the past, when we've talked about system modernization, it's been primarily limited to the highway system. And people don't see that their individual community needs are being addressed or even recognized. So I think if you do engage the ACTs, and I hope that you will, that you'll get a greater buy-in. That doesn't mean everybody's going to support every project, but the idea that they're being asked and being engaged and providing input and people are listening is very important to the communities and to the regions.
Thank you. Anything from the gentleman?
Chair Reed, the only thing I would add is it really truly is a system. In Wallowa County, when someone calls me up, they're in Wallowa County on vacation, and they've ripped the undercarriage out of their car on a county road, they're not happy with the system at all. So we do need to work on this collectively, and it is a really heavy lift. Someone asked me here a while back, if you had $1 million for your road department extra, what would you do? And I said, I'd crush rock and put it on our gravel roads because they're all wore out. Those aren't on projects like we just went through. And every county in the state has that kind of list. So It is a heavy lift, and we're here to help.
Thank you very much, Representative Benson.
Thank you. And I really can't thank you guys enough for the work you do on those acts. I've gone to a number of those meetings, both in NEAC and SEAC, and really been impressed with the calmness of everybody there for the most part. The chair mentioned that there's going to be a discussion, and already has started to be a discussion about a transportation package in a couple of years, and that translates into generally raising gas taxes. And so my question to the three of you is, if you want additional money for your areas, for those county roads, and I have a lot of them in my five counties that are in ever increasingly worse condition, are these acts a location for those kinds of discussions? And if so, are you or if not, is there some other place you would suggest we raise those issues? Because there's this odd, as you know all too well, relationship between taxes on the one hand and road improvements on the other. And so I guess I'm asking you guys, what's the right approach to this situation looking down the road a couple of years?
Chair Reed, Representative Benz, our area is focusing on safety, and we've always focused on safety. And the difficulty of this last go-around is we had many safety projects. We had some transit projects. They want to buy buses. And it's hard to balance that to which one is more important. They're all important. As in our area, we have a county, Polk County, passed their own bond and did their own maintenance for 20 years. And so their county roads are very well, I'll put it that way. And they did it again 20 years later, and they passed another bond and redid them. That's their way they do it. The other two counties, Marion and Yamhill counties, they just try to get by on what they've got. It's going to be difficult for us to add county roads into the formula if we're looking at state and local safety issues versus county roads that aren't used that much. But for our area, we're a little unique because everybody uses the state highway system to get through us. So,
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I think one of the values of the acts is that you're engaging both public sector and private sector in the conversation about transportation. And it is these same people who will go back to the entities that they represent. And if there is a need for greater revenue, and specifically a gas tax or something, then that conversation can start. And it's not going to be without controversy, and it's not going to be without disagreement. But you have to start the conversation at some point. Well, I consider one of my mentors in the act and in transportation in general, John Witte, who was a former Oregon Transportation Commissioner. He bugs me all the time. John and I go to the act together, and he says, we have got to raise the gas tax. It's not going to be popular, but that's what pays for things. And, you know, when you look at the fact that we haven't kept up with inflation, that's a big factor right there. And, you know, it's money out of people's pockets, but then those same people are the users of the system, and it's going to have to be both the conversation at the local level and an education process. One final comment I want to say is the ODOT personnel that we work with are just outstanding.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Well, one thing I'd like to add, when you talk about the difference in roads and what ODOT does, usually take the train up to Seattle, but the train broke, so I drove up there. I was appalled at the I-5 from here to Seattle, absolutely appalled. And our roads were so much better than the state of Washington. It was by comparison, we are just heads and tails above them. And I was so disappointed because I thought, you know, that on a federal corridor like that, it was very, very dangerous. And so I just, you know, really want to applaud ODOT because they do a good job of keeping our major highways and our smaller roads in very, very good shape. And I thank you.
Thank you, Representative Doherty.
And next time I'm going to take the train again. I'll wait for the new broken train.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Can I make a quick comment on
that,
please?
Sure, please.
Chair Reed, on the issue of how to use the acts, I think it's really important that, you know, people, generally speaking, don't like increased taxes. They especially don't like increased taxes if they don't know what the money's being used for. And I think the transportation system and how we get funded and so forth in those counties that have had timber receipts and historically, and that's been the bulk of our money, they definitely don't understand that. And so to be successful in a package, I think you've got to do a major educational effort, and I think the acts can help you in that.
That's a great place to conclude for today. We really appreciate you guys coming, in some cases a very long distance. We appreciate the expertise in your service, and I think it's reasonable to expect that we'll be talking again before too long. Thank you
but
very
he,
much.
But he got here on nice highways.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. So before we turn away from ODOT to a discussion of public-private partnerships, Mr. Mather mentioned an opportunity. Since we're all gathered here today, you've probably been following a little bit of the developments with respect to the I-5 bridge replacement. We wanted to see if people wanted to get a little update on that, where we sit relative to the opportunity that might come before the legislature. In general, I think it's fair to say that we're engaged in some information gathering, hearing from the Treasurer's Office, Department of Justice, and others are considering what options remain open to Oregon. If we take it no further than that, I want to make sure that people understand what's being contemplated is not a go-it-alone strategy. If the legislature decides to continue, it would obviously involve the federal government, the state of Washington, city of Vancouver, C-Tran, a variety of agencies. So I think there's plenty of room for people to come to different conclusions, but it's clear that if the legislature decided to move forward, it would not be a go-it-alone strategy. So I want to make sure that that's clear. And we are, as I said, waiting for some additional analysis from the Department of Justice and the Treasurer's Office, so just to make sure that the committee is aware of that. If there are discussions, Director Garrett's here, Mr. Strickler's here as well, or anything else people want to get into on that for just a few minutes. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's something that I hope you can confirm for us from what I've read of the project as it would be revised in a new strategy. It appears that improvements that benefited Washington only would be dropped from this phase or this version of the project. Is that correct? There were a couple of interchanges that appeared to benefit Washington. Only their side of the river.
Let me try to answer that, and whichever of you gentlemen would like to confirm or correct what I say. I think generally the interchanges in Washington, except for the one that's necessary for the bridge to land and function, would not be part of this phased and revised approach, but I'm happy to be corrected or amended.
I think, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of Oregon's Department of Transportation, and with me is Chris Strickler, the Columbia River Crossing Project Director. Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathanson, I would phrase it just a little bit differently. What we are promoting is a phased project that defers out the work that is just north of the SR-14 mm-hmm. interchange. That's where the bridge would come in and connect in the state of Washington. So we defer that out, and the choice is the state of Washington's at the time of their choosing to make investments to carry forth that part of the project.
Thank you. I appreciate the more careful wording. I think what probably would be of interest to my constituents who would want to talk about it is what are we paying for, and is Washington getting benefit from this project? But it clearly, some improvements that would be in the state of Washington will be Washington's obligation should they choose to proceed.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And I want to give people a chance to ask sort of general questions. Part of the point of having this update now is to reinforce that if the answers from the Treasurer's Office and the Department of Justice suggest that a fuller conversation is worthwhile, we will have that opportunity. We don't have to decide anything today, but just a general update and an opportunity to clarify questions and so on. Any other questions or comments? I don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So we'll move on to a discussion of how some of the innovative options that are available to us for financing transportation infrastructure projects. One thing that really strikes me is the a study I saw that has quantifies the amount of infrastructure needs just on the West Coast at about $1 trillion over the next 30 years. Even in the most optimistic scenarios, I think it's difficult for us to imagine how we might finance that as a state. So I think it's going to be necessary to find ways to stretch our public dollars and perhaps to involve private sector dollars. While we get someone on the phone here, I want to give Representative Davis a chance to describe his experience at NCSL, and maybe you can introduce our speaker a little bit. Representative Davis?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair.
Go ahead. Yeah, let's do it.
We'll be hearing today from Jim Reed, who is the group director with the National Conference of State Legislatures for the Energy, Environment, and Transportation section. He's a veteran of NCSL and NCSL's Public-Private Partnerships Committee and some of the endeavors that they have done. He's also been a part in authoring this book, which I'll pass down, and some of you have seen and have copies of. Some of you don't. For those who don't, it's on the meeting materials. It's been uploaded in full. This is NCSL's PPP for Transportation Toolkit for Legislators. And I'd just direct you, if you get bored, flip to the back, because what's most interesting is it has examples of PPPs.
Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt. Mr. Reed, this is Tobias Reed, Chair of the Transportation Economic Development Committee in Oregon. You are with us by phone. Our committee administrator is getting your presentation up on our screen, and Representative Davis, whom you know, is giving you an introduction.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. And thanks, Jim, for being here. Really appreciate it. I was just saying, if you're interested, flip to the back of this legislator's guide, because it's got concrete examples of PPPs as they've been used throughout the United States. These discussions in PPPs can sometimes turn into just throwing buzzwords around, and it's nice to see what some other states have actually done to implement public-private partnerships. But Jim, I think, will bring a real balanced voice, talk about some of the pitfalls that we've experienced throughout the United States with PPPs, some of the advantages, and bring a nice neutral viewpoint.
Thank you. So just to set a little more context for you, Mr. Reed, your voice is coming into a committee room with a handful of legislators at a dais, a handful of people in the audience, your presentation on a screen that we can all see. Up till now in our committee hearing, we've gotten an update from our Department of Transportation on some of the projects that are underway. We've heard from some of our area commissions on transportation around the state on their particular needs, and we've kind of put forward our discussion as a building block for the potential construction of a transportation package in a future session. So I think you're in a unique spot to tell us about some of the tools that might be part of a future package, and we're glad you're willing to be with us.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the invitation from Representative Davis to come before you by phone and talk about some of the work that NCSL has done in this area. So is the first slide up on the screen then for you there?
It is.
Okay, great. If we can go to the next slide on the NCSL overview, I just put this in for those that may not be familiar. We're your organization, and we work for all the state legislatures, and this is one of the things we do, bring balanced and bipartisan information to the states. And so I'm really, really pleased to be with you today. Next slide, please. You've mentioned some context that you've heard from today, and perhaps some of these topics have been raised, but clearly we've had a tough time over the last 5 years with the Great Recession, budget shortfalls, and so forth. So there is something of a crisis in funding transportation, as well as other areas of state government. What's unique, I think, to this area is the gas tax has been the primary source of revenues, both the federal gas tax and the state gas tax, and it's been on the decline for a number of years for a variety of reasons. Less driving, statistically, the vehicle miles traveled actually peaked back in about 08. And so ever since then, we have not come back to that peak. And many people think that VMTs are going to be rising slowly, meaning less driving. And we also have electric and hybrid vehicles that use less or no gasoline, so no funding is coming in from those from the gas tax from the gasoline those vehicles are not using. I make note that there's some political reluctance to raise the gas tax, and a number of states have slowly done it over the past number of years, but what's happened is it's a 6 cents per gallon at the federal level and in the states, and so it does not keep up with inflation. Some other issues, we've underinvested in our infrastructure over the years. It's maintenance is an easy thing to cut, if you will, when budgets are tight. There was stimulus money a few years ago, but it's all been spent, and that actually helped get over a decline that would have taken place. But now that money is gone, and really there's the federal program going forward. The current federal authorization was only for 2 years, and it expires in just a year from now. And so there'll be a lot of discussion about what the federal government is going to do in terms of assisting states. But I think the consensus at many of our meetings, and we're fortunate to have outstanding leadership at NCSL from one of your own in the Oregon legislature, Senator Bruce Starr, who's our current president. And what he's been saying and what others say at our meetings is the states are going to have to look to their own resources more than likely as the federal funding tends to dry up in years going forward. And really there hasn't been any kind of solution identified at the federal level for the funding requirements that are necessary. The current Highway Trust Fund will go into a deficit pretty soon, sometime next year. And so over the last several years at the federal level, the general funds has been put into the highway fund to keep it going. So there's a real issue there. Next slide. Again, setting just a little more context, states do fund transportation a variety of ways, and these are some averages from a 50-state study we did a few years ago. State motor fuels taxes are the largest portion in your average state at about 28%. Federal funding, that's the money that comes back to each state that you've already paid, that your motorists have paid in federal gas taxes, is second at 27. And then fees and so forth come in at 16%. We count borrowing and bonding in at 12%, tolls, and the rest you can see are smaller contributions. But this gives you just a sense of the percentages of where the revenue comes from, and as you think about going forward with your projects that you've mentioned. Next slide. As far as finance, I want to distinguish between financing and funding. Financing, of course, is basically borrowing, different forms of borrowing. Funding is new revenue that you would get from a new tax or fee or so forth. But on the financing front, there are a number of things that states do currently for transportation, and those are listed there. I won't walk through them, but down the list you'll see public-private partnerships, and that's what we'll focus on today. But there are a variety of methodologies and so forth that are available, and as you can see, most states use most of these techniques. Let me move to the next slide, the P3 option. Public-private partnerships. A few years back, there was a fair amount of interest in this, and I'll speak just a little bit about how we got started, but to introduce the idea, P3s can be used on larger scale transportation projects that can't be fully funded through traditional means. And when I say larger scale, the number I've heard with the sweet spot is, or some recommended funding levels, is somewhere in the $200 million range and on up. That P3s are probably most efficient because there is a fair amount of transactional kind of work that goes on in terms of how those come together. It does expand the pool of available money because it brings some private money, private equity to the table, and various studies have been done over the last number of years, talking about how much private equity money might be available to put into infrastructure, not only transportation, but other kinds. And the estimates are, you know, in the $200 billion range. So it's a, that's a fairly large amount of money. There is studies have shown that the P3s can create cost savings because many times you'll have a lower initial project cost because of the competition that comes from private sector consortiums and so forth bidding against each other, as well as quicker project completion. And if there's a long-term maintenance and operational contract involved, those costs can be capped and, as well, or controlled anyway, through a long-term maintenance and operational contract. A really key thing is the risk, and I'll talk briefly about risk as I go on. Private sector takes on some of the risk that a public entity would normally take on, and that can be a benefit to the private, to the public entity. And finally, there's more of an opportunity to bring private sector innovations and practices into the public sector, which can increase efficiency. So these are some of the arguments in favor of looking at P3s that are put out there. Next slide. This is a map of state legislation relative to P3s, and you can see there's a couple of colors there. The darker blue is broader enabling legislation, which your state has. And the lighter blue is limited or project-specific, so that those are more, again, project-specific related legislation. You can see that, you know, a number of states, 33, have enacted this as a tool in their toolkit to fund transportation. Next slide. This shows just the, I guess, the trend over the last 5 years, more interest in this year, and sort of building over time, and each of those years on there, anywhere from 3 to 5 states enacted this type of legislation. And so at this point in time, the text there, the figure I read recently, there's about $60 billion in the U.S., in terms of transportation P3s that have been put into, that have been constructed over 20 years. And at the current time, there's about 11 projects that are coming to bid in the next, 18 months or so, year and a half, amounting to around $30 billion. And Representative Davis referenced one of the appendices of our report that talks about what projects are out there. So these 11 probably wouldn't be in there because they're newer projects, but I can find out what those are and pass them along. So next slide. We had a fair amount of interest in this back in the 09 context, and actually Congress was considering putting some restrictions on the states, and this is really a state opportunity. This is a state initiative. It's not something that's done federally. But there was some concern about any kind of restrictions that might be put on the states. And so our we organized, through our leadership at NCSL, a working group that took a look at P3s to find out what was involved and to give guidance, kind of like I'm doing today, to share that with states that were interested, not taking a pro or con, but looking at kind of all sides and coming out with some guidance. Next slide. It involved, we sought some funding from our foundation, and we involved a number of states, Oregon being one of them, in the person of Bruce Starr. And you can see the list of, we involved a number of associations in private sector and labor unions and entities that have an interest in trying to get a balance on this. So we came up with a pretty good balanced group of folks. We had the design-build folks. We had attorneys dealing with these kinds of issues. We had construction companies, capital firms, and so forth. Next slide. So what we came up with was a toolkit, a state legislator's toolkit, to provide nonpartisan, balanced, useful information, we hope, and it has has turned out that way. We've had a number of states be able to use this. And it included some context. And I believe you have this document in front of you. Is that right, Mr. Chairman? Is this document been made available?
We do. We have it. We have it electronically.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So the idea was to create some, to explain the context, to talk about the state government roles and issue some principles for good governance as they might be applied to P3s should a state decide. And again, we're not saying a state should do it or not. It's really a matter of analysis and assessing, and you've already passed a statute. So a lot of what we've done is to say, if you have a statute, here's some ways to implement it in a robust way as well. Next slide. Some of the key assumptions, and I mentioned this, the states are primarily responsible and should be for this kind of policy decision and implementation. And really the key is that if you're going to proceed with this, any public entity, you will need solid, balanced, comprehensive state-enabling legislation. And I've looked at your legislation, and I think you're in good shape in that regard. Many of the bills that were considered in legislatures this year were tweaking, changing this or that based on some of their experience, and certainly that's always a good thing to do, to look at your legislation and do that. The third point there is that E3s are not ideal for all transportation projects. I've mentioned something of a dollar figure where it may not make as much sense below that, but it can accelerate a project's delivery and get something done now that maybe in your long-range transportation plan it's otherwise wouldn't occur for a long time, 20 years. But the underlying point there is that P3s don't create new money. Just want to make sure you're all, and I think you're all aware of that, it's more of a finance and risk-sharing kind of arrangement, a procurement arrangement. It's not new dollars that you are creating. Those dollars that come from the private sector will have to be paid back through either existing taxes or tolls, and we can talk a bit more about that in a moment. Next slide. The definition, sorry about this slide, it's a little wordy, but essentially a P3 is a contractual agreement between public and private that allows more participation on the private side than is traditional. They involve a government agency contracting with a private company or consortium or contractor to do a construction project start to finish and possibly even maintain and operate as well. Another definition I saw talked about through an agreement like this, the skills and assets of each sector, the private and public, are shared in delivering a service or a facility for the use of the public. And that involves an appropriate allocation of risks. And I'll talk about risk. I think that's one of the benefits of a P3 arrangement is the appropriate entity takes on the risks of this kind of a construction project. Next slide. So our toolkit basically defined roles at the legislative level and the executive level. Basically, I think it's pretty self-explanatory. It is your role as a legislative body to decide whether a state's going to do this or not and to create a framework and decide what the legislative role is, and then delegate to the executive the implementation and the authority to undertake the programs, projects, procurement, and so forth to get the job done. Next slide. In terms of shared roles, there's a number here, and the key among that, and this is one of the things you hear about P3s, is that the public sector needs to have some fairly robust capacity to be able to implement these kind of arrangements. So that's really number one and two there. One way to do that is through a center of expertise, and I'll mention at the end some states that have done that either in their DOT for transportation or perhaps in another agency that would be more broadly over several agencies of state government to help provide expertise to those agencies that are implementing P3s. And then really it'd be a shared responsibility to engage the public, and this is, I think, a really key point to be made, that all along the way, the buy-in of the public and other stakeholders is really important, so that there is not last-minute opposition or just to try and answer the questions along the way. And then selecting or approving projects, and that varies state to state. Many states, the legislature authorizes the DOT to go forward with this, and the legislature reviews it at various junctures. Next slide. And this slide talks about legislative approval. In most states, there's in Oregon, this is the case too, as I read your statute, the DOT is delegated the authority to go forward with P3s and not have to come back to the legislature. Other states do it a little differently. There's 8 states that do require some form of legislative approval for some or all P3 projects, and this just kind of gives a rundown of that. There's a few states that at the bottom there talk about they do a review or some type of involvement, perhaps some oversight, but not approval per se. State of Washington, your sister state, does this through the process of approving the plan, the annual project plan that the DOT brings to the legislature. Next slide. This slide and the next really summarize, just by title, if you will, some of the benefits and concerns. This could be actually a pretty long discussion, and I don't want to... I think it's pretty well spelled out in the report, but we did want to characterize this the different concerns and benefits that are consistently raised around this issue, and kind of list them here. So I've listed them here. They are available in the guide, starting, I believe, on page 10. But these are some of the. Let me just pick out a few key items here. I think on the benefits slide there, the cost and time savings and life cycle efficiencies are really, I think, a couple of the important benefits because those can be incentives built into the contract for on-time delivery and disincentives for failure to meet performance requirements that maybe. Can be pretty robust as well. If there's an operations and maintenance part of this that could extend over a number of years, one of the theories, and I think it plays out in practice, is it's the same consortium involved, and the beginning to the end, there's incentive to build the project, to design and build the project well, so that it'll hold up over time, and so that maintenance and operation costs are less, and so you don't have kind of more the typical situation where a company builds a project and then they're done with it, and so whatever goes wrong later, after a warranty is up or whatever, is not their concern. And in these kinds of arrangements, there's a little more skin in the game, I guess, to do well at the front end, and then over time to minimize maintenance and operation costs because it was done a good job was done in the beginning. Next slide, the slide on concerns. There's a number here, and I'd be happy to respond to any issues. I think some of these issues are able to be handled through the agreement that's negotiated between the public agency and the private sector consortium, and a lot of this is negotiated, hopefully, in favor of the public interest, and I think. There's ongoing concerns about how that's defined and how it plays out, but I guess one of the points I would make here is the contract, the agreement that's signed is really key to making these arrangements work well. And it can cover many of these topics that come up. For instance, bankruptcy or default has occurred. There was a case in Southern California where it was called the SBX, went bankrupt, but at the end of the day, the state was made whole because there was a fund was created that was most partially capitalized, not fully capitalized, that covered some of the costs of the facility changing hands, and then the state did take it over. But in terms of a lot of the contingencies were covered through the contract there. Down the list here, there's a variety of concerns that come up. Foreign ownership is an issue, controversies over toll roads and so forth. So just kind of want to identify these items there. We can talk more about it as your questions might guide us. Next slide. I want to be aware of the time and move through these relatively quickly because it is in front of you, but the centerpiece of our work was the nine principles, and so we came up with these based on a lot of input from experts, from the states that have done this, from a variety of sources. We heard from advocates, we heard from those that question the practice and so forth. So the idea was to give some broad framework and guidance to both states that have P3 legislation on the books to guide their implementation and for states that hadn't already done so. Next slide. So principle one, be informed, is a little bit of a, we know we need to be informed. But we felt like it was important to talk about that and to do what you're doing now, bringing forward, bringing information to your deliberations from other people's experience. And, in terms of states that are looking at this that haven't done it, we've recommended, a commission or some kind of study group that really get their arms around it before going forward. But clearly, you're already implementing number one there. Let me move to two, separate the debates. One of the elements we ran into was places where an argument about to toll or not to toll became the focus of public discussion, and the P3 type arrangement was a bit off to the side. So what we were told and what the group ended up recommending was to try and clarify that, deciding to do public-private partnerships as a policy initiative is a separate debate from, a particular project that might involve a toll. There are options, alternatives to tolls, using other funding sources that the state or a public entity might have, and paying those out in terms of availability payments, paying the consortium as the facility becomes available, however that's defined in the contract. So what people brought to us was that sometimes the argument over tolling could derail the whole process of discussing the P3 arrangement, which really is can involve tolls, but it's also a whole variety of other things that I've mentioned. Next slide. Look at the public interest for a variety of stakeholders. We had a fair amount of discussion on what is the public interest and how to protect it, and of course we're as your organization serving state legislators, we believe that it's one of your primary jobs to do that. And as part of the exercise of looking at this, just to hear from all the stakeholders and where they might be coming from, and to compare a P3 project delivery to traditional delivery and see what that might involve. And I think you do this just in the course of your normal business, but we wanted to call it out as especially important. As I mentioned, there's an education learning curve here that is pretty steep in places where this hasn't been done a lot. And I know you've done a few projects there. Next slide. Number four sort of carries on from three, involve and educate stakeholders early and often. And this is directed both at the legislature, you know, in terms of you as individual members who go back to your district to talk about this, but also clearly the implementing agency, and to really be as transparent and as possible of balancing. At the end of the day, there's aspects of the contract that'll be negotiated that have to be confidential because of proprietary business practices or so forth. But as much as the public entity, the legislative branch and executive can involve and educate stakeholders, this is all to the benefit in the long run, and it may take more time at the front end to do that. Next slide. Number five, this really came through. It's a longer-term perspective that I think is a benefit of B3s, because often it does involve the operation and maintenance contract that I've mentioned, but it can allow you then in your deliberations to take a longer view as well. Next slide. This was an important point that was brought out a number of times, that you have your plans, your transportation plans that are in place, and that as much as possible, this is a tool to implement that plan, as opposed to sometimes, and it can be beneficial in some cases, but there is some states allow unsolicited bids, so someone comes to you that, you know, may not be in your plan, and then it's you know, a decision as to whether you go forward with it. But most of the advice we received from folks that have done this was to try and fit it in with your existing planning process. Next slide. Number seven is something that's newer, I think, to the U.S., but in other places, in Britain and Australia, Canada, some other places have done more of this. They do a fairly robust project analysis, and there's a couple of terms there, value for money analysis and a public sector comparator, and that's basically a study where you look at doing a particular project through a purely public sector approach or through a P3 approach, and then determine how it plays out. I know the state of Virginia uses this, and there's a couple other states listed there. Florida, Maryland, Puerto Rico, and Washington also have some kind of project analysis. But if you do that on the front end, it can often be create some clarity as to which way to go. And I make note there that the Federal Highway Administration has some new tools that they've just developed in the last several months that are exactly along these lines that I think would be very, very useful. And I can provide a website to the staff on that later on.
Thank you.
Next slide. Kind of closing up the principles here. Be clear and transparent about financial issues. And I think this applies maybe a little more if you're talking about a monetization where you have an existing asset, a toll road that is being monetized, where or leased to a public, a private entity with an upfront payment. And that happened in Indiana, Chicago, but, you know, eight or so years ago. And one of the issues is, what are you going to do with the money? And so as much as that can be spelled out in terms of the public process, that's a good thing. And then finally, your legislation and your implementing rules, and we've heard this a lot, set good ground rules for the process. So yeah, it's a level playing field for all of the private bidders in terms of, you know, the procurement, the evaluation criteria, the process, and so forth. Next slide. A couple more things. I mentioned the expertise issue. A number of states have created offices that specialize in this. Decided that this is going to be a policy option they're going to pursue, and they've created these offices, and I've just listed them here. Most of them are in DOTs. Some are out of DOTs. They're in Treasury Department in the case of Michigan. In the case of Puerto Rico, they've created an authority that works with all agencies of state government there. Next slide. Just a couple parts of the toolkit I would draw your attention to, a glossary, you know, just the different terms that are used. There's a pretty useful checklist that the Pew group came up with. They did a sort of a postmortem on the Pennsylvania situation back in 08, where there was a potential lease of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and they came up with some questions, some checklists to look at, you know, in terms of evaluating the appropriateness of doing it through the P3 process, you know, whatever project. Then there's a bibliography, of course, there. I mentioned earlier availability payments. It's an alternative to tolling. It's simply using other funds, state funds or public agency funds that are from other sources, and they're paid out as the facility becomes available. Well, next slide. We're happy to continue working with you. We can provide additional information, as this was fairly cursory, but I hope it was useful. We can come in person or bring others to bring other points of view as your needs dictate. And the final slide is my contact information. So I appreciate the time, Mr. Chairman, and I know I've taken some of your time. I hope it was useful. I'm happy to respond to any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you very much. It was a good, comprehensive overview, and we definitely appreciate it. Are there any questions from the committee? One thing I would really like to underscore and maybe have you reiterate very briefly is what little exposure I've had to the concept. The idea of saying public-private partnership often brings a lot of associations to mind for certain people, and often they're different. And in other words, just saying public-private partnership means lots of different things to lots of different people. And if I'd love to have you react to that statement, and if I understood you correctly, the notion that the concepts can come in many different varieties, flavors, and sizes, depending on the circumstances.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. It's absolutely true. People have a whole variety of reactions to what it is and what they think it is, or what they've, you know, a particular anecdote that they've had, or maybe, you know, depending on where they've been on the issue. Let me, I meant to bring this up on page 4 and 5. It talks about the variety of sort of the spectrum of public-private partnerships, the arrangements that sort of fit under that rubric. And so you have, you know, design-build is a public-private partnership under many definitions. Some don't call it that, but that's, you know, the process, and I believe you have it in Oregon, where the design and build processes are more combined and in the construction, and it creates more interaction, more collaboration between those elements, and ultimately ends up being a more effective facility. But then you have a spectrum there on page 4 of various pieces of this, and so yes, it's confusing in one sense. You have on the far end, where there's been some confusion about the what I mentioned in Chicago and Indiana, where public assets were sold, given away, or sold to the private sector, and it's not the case. Really, one of the, I guess, baseline definitions of public-private partnerships is that the public sector retains control and retains ownership, and it's a leasing situation. On the next page there, it's a sort of a risk table, and talking about the different project delivery models. And this is you know, a whole week's long seminar going through this, but various one of the benefits of P3s is the risk can be taken on by the private sector for various things. And the dot there shows, based on the model, what kind of risk can be assumed on the private side. So you've got Right. You know, finance risk can be taken on the private side, which normally would be a public risk. And then, you know, if it's a maintenance situation, that's the risk on the private side and so forth. So a little of this is getting into the weeds a bit, but it's exactly what you said, Mr. Chairman. There's different associations, and really that was the basis of our effort. There was sort of a misinformation all the way around, and so that was the purpose of putting this information together.
And we appreciate that. We're going to move to a little bit more local version of this, a couple of things that you may already know about that are happening yes. in Oregon, and we're glad to have you remain on the phone if you want to. On the other hand, we recognize that it's an hour later in Colorado, and you've been generous with your time already, so up to you whether you'd like to stick around by phone or we can say thank you and goodbye.
I appreciate that. Let me stay on the line for you know, maybe 10 or 15 more minutes, because I would like to get a flavor of what else you're talking about. Thank you.
Very good. So great. We'd like to invite John Mullis and Chris Taylor up. While you guys are getting settled, I'll note just the dual role that Chris is going to play. Maybe John, you'd like to go first. Chris will be here sort of as general comments on the public-private partnership concept, I think. And then he is also the executive director of the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange and can provide some of an update on that. You remember that the legislature passed House Bill 2345 to allow us to consider how Oregon might participate in the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. So, Mr. Mullis.
Well, thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. John Mullis with the Oregon State Building Rights Council. And the notion of our pension funds investing in infrastructure projects is a relatively new concept. And so I thought, with your permission, I'd just give a brief overview of our pension funds and real estate funds and where they've come from in the past and how we're trying to switch gears a little bit and take advantage of this new opportunity.
Yes, please.
So the 13 international unions that are affiliated with the Building Trades Department and the local unions in Oregon that are affiliated with them are all very fortunate to have defined benefit pension plans at both the national level and the local level for our members in cooperation with our signatory employers. And these have been the traditional balance funds with stocks and bonds. And then in the 70s and 80s, we started exploring the possibility of adding real estate funds as another component. And there was two main reasons for that. One was just to provide another investment option that the funds could avail themselves of that could provide good returns. And then the second one, especially in the 80s, was just to try and scare up some work for our members and contractors. As you'll all remember, that was another very serious downturn in our economy. And these funds range from national level funds, such as the Multi-Employer Property Trust and the AFL-CIO Housing Investment Trust and Building Investment Trust, which are multi-billion dollar funds, to local firms such as Washington Capital Management, Quest Investment Management, and McMorgan and Company. And some of the local projects and investments and holdings, some examples of those would be many of the industrial properties in the Rivergate area in North Portland, several of the warehouses on Airport Way east of I-205, holdings in both the South Waterfront and Brewery Blocks, the Oregon Clinic in Northeast Portland, and numerous other office buildings, condos, apartments, and retail and corporate centers, not only in Portland but throughout the state. And these represent hundreds of millions of dollars of investments from our funds and well north of $1 billion in holdings. So 5 or 6 years ago, when the economy tanked and we went almost literally from full employment to 35 to 40% unemployment in a matter of a week or two, it seemed like, people stepped back and realized we weren't going to be building many office buildings or retail centers or apartments or condos for several years. And so the discussion started on how could we maybe take some of these pension funds and start investing them into infrastructure projects. projects. Everybody knows the need for infrastructure funding is great, and funding them is very difficult. And so over the last few years, McMorgan & Company and ULICO, which is the Union Labor Life Insurance Company, have both started separate funds within their holdings to fund infrastructure projects. I have provided you with a handout from McMorgan. I didn't get the one from ULICO in time, but I hope to get it by email, and I'll forward it to your committee administrator. The AFL-CIO Housing Investment Trust added hospitals, which isn't a normal public infrastructure project, but to most towns, especially small towns, hospitals are a pretty important part of their infrastructure. And you can see in the flyer that I gave you from that firm that they financed the Coquiel Hospital a couple of years ago. And so to have a couple hundred union jobs created on the South Oregon coast when our members were 40 to 60% unemployed was a pretty pretty meaningful. And then the Multi-Employer Property Trust has started a fund to help fund renewable energy projects. Obviously, prevailing wage is very important to us, and we believe as long as it's a public asset, prevailing wage should always apply no matter how it's funded. But we're pleased to be moving in this new direction and finding funds available to try and help finance some of these public-private partnerships. And I sincerely hope that within the next year or a couple years that our funds will be able to help fund some of these projects in Oregon. So, again, thanks for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, and I do my best to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Questions from the panel?
So,
Representative.
Sure. I think this is pretty exciting. So the question I have then, given the fact that especially the one where there's an infrastructure fund being established, so what's the timing in which you would be, that fund would be in a position of that in order to consider a project, or is it already in that position?
Chair Reed, Representative Lively, there's a couple of the funds. ULICO is capitalized enough to start looking at projects, and so is McMorgan. I hate to even say this, but one of those funds is actually looking at having a conversation with Multnomah County over their courthouse, which I think would be a very exciting opportunity.
Absolutely. And maybe to follow up on that, would you say that there's momentum, perhaps other vehicles beyond the ones that you've named that are looking at this sort of possibility?
Chair Reed, yes, I believe that's true. There's other opportunities, I think not only within these funds, but from the funds themselves that might be looking internally to say, how could we purchase bonds or do something to help try and move these some of these projects forward. So it's definitely become a bigger topic of conversation.
Great. Terrific. Great. Other questions? Let's see. Well, you're welcome to stay there or excuse yourself. Hopefully we're going to have some conversation with Chris as well.
So I'll be happy to stay because this next topic is very important to us as well. Thank you.
Very good. Thanks. Chris, thanks for hanging in and being here at the end of the day. We're excited to hear from you.
Well, thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Taylor, the Executive Director of the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. I apologize, I didn't know exactly the content of Mr. Reed's testimony, so I will try to avoid duplicating what's already been covered, and I think he actually gave a fantastic overview of the topic and basically the points that he highlighted as being sort of important things to reflect on. I would underscore all of those. In particular, I think that I was actually joking with someone back here that I think that the graphic on their page 4 that sort of shows the spectrum, the continuum of what represents a public-private partnership is really, really important. As Chairman Reed pointed out, a lot of times people think of these asset sales of public assets as what that means, which is, as they correctly define it here, outside the spectrum of what most people would actually call a PPP. And there's a wide range of different ways that the private sector can be involved. And there's no one-size-fits-all solution. So I was going to give a brief introduction as to what the exchange is, and then I will try to avoid repeating anything that's already been covered by others. Sorry, it's my first time doing this. You guys know this, but it's always good to remind people. We heard a lot about roads today, which is certainly one of the most expensive and critical pieces of our infrastructure in need of funding and has a particularly acute situation due to the historical funding sources and the declines that you heard about in a lot of detail. But the need for infrastructure goes much further than that and includes things like our drinking water plants, our sewage treatment plants. Quick factoid to remember about both of those is that the construction of many of those systems was driven by legislation passed in the federal level. The Clean Water Act was passed in the 1970s. A lot of the new sewage treatment plants were built to comply with that, which makes them 40-something years old, which is sort of the design life of many of those facilities. Similarly, the Safe Drinking Water Act was passed in the federal level in the early 80s. So all the projects that were built to comply with that are now 30-something years old. So you've got a lot of projects in that asset class that are going to be reaching the end of their life, unfortunately, all around the same time. You've also, you hear about schools all the time, similar problems there with a lot of buildings that were built many years ago. We've got dams. We've heard about bridges. The numbers are staggering, and where we're going to come up with it is a real challenge. So what are we doing about it? What can we do about it? I'm going to talk briefly about what the exchange is doing, some other things happening here in Oregon. So I broke this into strategies to reduce costs and attract private capital. And I want to always emphasize the difference between funding and financing. Funding is taxes and fees. That's what you all have control over. Financing is where you borrow the money and how you structure the transaction. But at the end of the day, financing needs to get paid back with funding. The West Coast Infrastructure Exchange was established to create a regional market. Oregon is a relatively, those are some big numbers, but in the grand scheme of global infrastructure, we're a relatively small market. We're a relatively small state, 1% of the U.S. population. And one of the goals of the exchange is by uniting with the other states along the West Coast, which are much bigger than us, along with B.C., creates a bigger market that will attract more interest from the funds that John was describing, as well as the most sophisticated contractors that have done these projects across the country and across the world to invite those people to compete and give us the best options as a state. A forum to share best practices and not recreate the wheel. I really would underscore what Mr. Reed said about the importance of that public sector capacity. This is a different way of doing business, and we've got some of that capacity here in Oregon. ODOT has had an office of partnerships for some time, but that's really focused on transportation. We haven't looked at that across other asset classes for infrastructure. And the sad reality that there's not a lot of federal action on this, so regions and states have to come up with their own solutions, at least based on what we're seeing out of Congress today. Chairman Reed mentioned House Bill 2345, which set up a task force to look at both participation in the West Coast Exchange as well as the creation of a state-level partnerships Oregon-type entity modeled after the successful example in British Columbia. That task force will be having its first meeting soon, and some members of this committee will be on that. So once we can get that scheduled, look forward to working with you on that. But the goal there is to have that capacity at the state level to do this across different categories of assets and also potentially to play that role on behalf of local jurisdictions, because a lot of the infrastructure that gets built, as you heard about county roads earlier today, but the same thing, we talk about water, talk about schools, those are not typically state driven. The state may provide some of the funds, but they're carried out at the local level, and we need that expertise and that capacity there as well. This is largely the same concepts that were covered by NCSL, so I will try to skip over anything that's redundant. I think most of this, pretty much different words, different bullets, but trying to convey the same concepts about risk transfer, competition, innovation. We're talking about the public sector owning these things. And the life cycle cost is really, really important. I've got a couple slides here I think that'll help explain that. I find pictures sometimes help make it easier to understand things. This is an attempt to show what many of these other graphics show, which is what's in the public's wheel, and hopefully nobody's colorblind, because I just realized this is a totally useless graphic if you're colorblind, and green is one of the colors people can't
see. That's right.
I should change that. Note to self. The design build are the two in here that are in green, if anyone's in that category. So that's the traditional delivery model, where the private sector is responsible for designing and building the project. All the rest is on the public side. In the partnership delivery model, you could have everything from the design, the building, the maintenance, facility management services, and financing as a private responsibility. this is a point I'd like to emphasize here. This chart is a spending on local government spending on water and wastewater from the 50s to 2008. The point of this is that the blue line is total spend, the purple one is O&M, and the green is capital. And the point being, O&M, at least in this sector of infrastructure, is actually quite a bit greater than capital. The current system that we have of focusing on least cost to build kind of ignores that purple line, which is bigger than the green line. And I'm not saying that this is happening in all asset classes, and it may not be true for something like a bridge. The maintenance may be less than, but for certain many types of infrastructure, the operational costs are really significant. And we have a history in this country at all levels of government of underinvesting in the maintenance of infrastructure, which is one of the reasons that we're in the state we're in, is because we haven't spent the money to maintain it. The point of this is that looking at the life cycle cost of an asset and saying we as the public are going to own this thing for the next 30, 40 years, we don't just want the cheapest cost to buy, we want the cheapest all-in cost to own and operate it safely over the lifetime. You think about when you go to buy a new car or buy a new water heater that, you know, the federal government requires a statement on there what it's going to cost you if you buy this one versus that one. That's an attempt to get people to think about it, and it's something that we need to be thinking about in terms of public policy. And part of the benefit of these structures is that it puts a private party responsible for all of those facets so that they really think about what's the cheapest way to build something that's also going to last over the long term, which is somewhat absent from the traditional structure. This really is just another graph, which I don't think is as good as John Reed's, so I'll skip over it. I like his better. This one is an attempt to talk about where do these savings come from? So the idea here is that, you know, there's a base cost to build the thing. You know, there's rebar, there's concrete, there's labor. Those things aren't going to change. You got to build the thing. Then you've got financing costs in a innovative finance where you're bringing in private money. Those financing costs are actually going to be higher, right? Because public tax-exempt debt is probably in the 3% range, and any private investor is going to be wanting to earn more than that. So those costs might actually go up, and the base costs might go up because they're wearing that risk, and so they're going to charge some premium for that. But then there's a bunch of other risks that we put off onto the other party, which is cost overruns during construction, cost certainty around the cost to maintain it. So the cost of that risk goes down under the innovative model, and then ancillary costs. The other piece of this is that if there truly is an innovation in how you design the project, you could drive those base costs down with a better design. But just trying to map out, there's some things that are going to go up and there are things that are going to go down.
Interrupt for just a second. Represent Benson's question.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
back to your previous slide there.
Apologize. Yeah,
right there. So why does risk retain go down?
Because you're transferring some of those risks to the private party. They're charging you a risk premium somewhere in the game, but there's a bunch of, in the traditional structure, there's a lot of open-ended, uncapped risks, right? Once you start building the project, you're not going to stop halfway, and if you find out that it costs a lot more, that results in change orders that end up being transferred to the public side. The second piece would be the operational costs. There are projections, of course, when projects are approved by this body or any other. Estimates are made, good faith estimates are made, but if those don't prove to be accurate, there's nobody to go after, right? That's just a cost that gets passed along, ultimately, to taxpayers in some form or another. If you have a binding contract that says you're responsible for maintaining this asset for 20, 30 years, then there is somebody who's on the hook for those numbers being all there is. Does that make sense?
Follow up. Yeah. Yeah, if everything was right, which it never is, I suppose, the reduction in your risk retained would find its way right down into base costs, which it kind of has, and it would drive base costs on up to equate that. That's where it would be if everything would work the way it's supposed to, and that would mean that the primary savings would appear to be in ancillary costs. Am I correct there, or am I?
So I think there's two main drivers, and this is not meant to be quantitative. Those sizes and the arrows are for indicative purposes only. So I think that the two primary areas would be one on innovation and how you design. I have a couple concrete examples I'd like to turn to that might better illustrate this than in the abstract.
It probably include things other than concrete too, right?
Yes. Yes. Tangible examples. But so an innovative design, a different way of delivering a service. Really what this boils down to make it maybe easier to understand is it's the difference between having people bid on a construction spec, a construction drawing, versus here's a whole bunch of performance specifications. Here's what we want this thing to do. Here's what it needs to be able to handle so many vehicles a day or house so many inmates a day or whatever the metrics are, and then performance metrics for that, and letting people figure out if they're responsible to design it, build it, and maintain it, what's the most creative way of doing that. And that could actually, and I'll give you a couple examples of how that could actually result in lower costs. But the risk issue, that's why it doesn't always make sense to do this approach, and I'll get to that. In fact, you might find that transferring that some risks is not cost effective. I mean, that's part of why I agree with what NCSL said. You've got to evaluate that in a rigorous quantitative way and decide if you are, if that's a risk worth transferring. And I'll give a couple examples of risks that I don't think transfer very well in the current market. So Partnerships BC is an example that we've cited. They're one of the participants in the exchange. They've been very generous with their time and their expertise. They've been around now since 2002. They've completed 38 projects, about $17.5 billion worth. And the main benefits there have been greater value for money, reduced risk for the taxpayer, greater certainty on project cost and schedule. And they've done things across the whole spectrum: schools, higher ed, of course, hospitals are. It's a national healthcare scheme there, so they built hospitals, detention facilities. They're building a hydro dam, kind of any kind of infrastructure you can imagine. And they are basically a consultant to whoever it is that has the organic authority to build and fund a project. So that could be the Ministry of Education. It could be a local sewer district. And they're that center of expertise that was highlighted in the previous presentation.
And you may remember, committee, we heard from Sarah Clark during the regular session, the president of Partnerships BC, who was here.
So again, this is, I think, largely been covered, so I will try to only highlight what I think. One other sort of quantitative result recently, there was a study that just came out in the last month from the Conference Board of Canada, which is a sister organization to the Conference Board here in the U.S., studying all of the most recent P3 activity across Canada. And what they found as sort of a postmortem on what that had achieved is that overall 13% higher value for money. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but when we're talking about billions of dollars, 13% starts to be pretty meaningful savings. And I think very compelling was the fact that 83% of all those projects were on time, and 95% of them were within 6 months of scheduled delivery. There was basically one project that was more than 6 months delayed. And, you know, we hit those kind of metrics in some sectors in this state. We heard some pretty compelling statistics from ODOT today, but it's certainly not the case across the board. And that's an important element of the risk transfer. And it's really having a contract that puts that party on the hook for the whole design, build, and maintenance piece that achieves that. So here's a couple of concrete examples that hopefully Representative Benz will illustrate the point I was trying to make. This is the one I actually think is the best example. So this is a pre-trial service center expansion, not all that dissimilar to our Multnomah County Courthouse that was mentioned earlier. So they were renovating and expanding this existing facility. The Ministry of Justice, I believe, had come up with their estimate of how much it would cost and what they could get for that. And then they put it out to bid instead of prescriptively with performance metrics. And the bidders that came back actually came up with, they got more functionality for less money. So instead of, they thought it would cost $148 million, and they would get certain benefits out of that. Instead, it only cost them $133 million, and they got a whole bunch of other things they hadn't thought about that improved both prisoner safety, safety of the people who work there. One of the things was having, and anyone who's been to Multnomah County Courthouse will appreciate this, an underground passageway for people who are, being tried for violent crimes to get to where they're going to go to their hearing rather than in the elevator with all the citizens and the jurors. They got that. They got a whole bunch of better security systems and things that would make the people who are the inmates, their lives less unpleasant. So they got big safety improvements, and it cost them less money. So that's one example. If someone just came up with a better design because they were given the chance to look at the whole scope as opposed to the way things traditionally work is you do the design first, and then everybody bids on that. Another one that I put up here just because a lot of us may have been up there before. If anyone's ever headed up to Whistler at any time, Prior to the Olympics, you know, it's a dangerous, windy road prone to fog and inclement weather. With all the people that they were going to be hosting with the Olympics, they knew they needed to improve it. So here's some pretty quantifiable statistics. The Ministry of Transportation had basically come up with what they call an affordability ceiling of what they could afford was $600 million. They thought they could get 60 kilometers of it, and I apologize, it's in kilometers, but it's Canada, 60 kilometers of passing lanes and 20 kilometers of median barrier and then more reflective markings on only the dangerous turns. When they went with the DBFM approach, which is design, build, finance, maintain, they got another $100 million in additional value in the form of 80 kilometers of passing lanes, so that's a fully a third more than what they thought they could get, 16 kilometers more median barrier, which is slightly less than twice what they thought they could get, and reflective safety material along the entire length of the road. And in this case, the contractor is going to be responsible for long-term performance monitoring and penalties. And I just make a point about that. It's important to think about systems. So in another example, they're extending their light rail system in Vancouver, and they're doing that one line as a B3, but they're not putting the day-to-day maintenance in that contract because they already have a skilled workforce of public employees that maintain the rest of that light rail system, and subbing out just one piece of it was, they found, not economically efficient. But there's still warranties and performance metrics that the builder is responsible for. So these things have to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. House Bill 2345, just, you know, I think that's been covered. You'll be seeing recommendations from the task force in January of 14, and we'll leave that to then. I do want, I think these are, were covered by NCSL, but I think really important to remind that these are publicly owned projects. These are not, we're not talking about, we're not advocating selling off existing assets to fill budget deficits, and would concur with Mr. Mullis that these are public projects and therefore prevailing wage should apply. This isn't saving money by taking it out of the backs of workers. This is finding more efficient ways to design and operate these systems, and those main savings aren't going to come from paying workers less. It's we're reducing taxpayer risk through these long-term performance contracts and higher value for money. And so really where I see this fitting in, if I may, the overall picture is that at the end of the day, we do have a funding problem. We need to come up with more ways to pay for these things. This will allow those dollars that we have to go further so we can get more projects built with whatever finite amount of money we're able to cobble together. And I don't envy you with the task that you have before you of figuring out where that money is going to come from. But the second thing I think it can do is to demonstrate to the public that there, and I heard someone else say it today, the public will support things when they know what it is and they get it and they believe that their money is being well spent. And we certainly have lots of successful infrastructure projects that have been done the traditional way. I think this is an approach that will give us higher certainty of those outcomes, and that's how we're going to build the support both in this building and in the state at large, that the people will be supportive of making those investments if they think their money is being well spent and they see projects that are delivered on time and on budget. That gets, we need to do a better job of publicizing those successes for sure. Finally, what are some of the actions we need to take to get there? We heard about the capacity need. It's really important. I mean, the people, by and large, people at state and local governments, with some exceptions, ODOT being the principal exception, the people that are making procurement decisions for infrastructure have, you know, come up through a system where design, bid, build, and traditional public financing of all assets is just, that's how it's done. So they're good at it. They know how to do it. And a lot of those people, if you talk to them, will say, yeah, I realize there's a lot of shortcomings to the current system, but that's what we know how to do. That's what we're comfortable with. And if we're going to get people, these are complicated contracts, and most of the bad examples of things that didn't go well were largely because the public side wasn't well represented, or somebody made some bad decisions negotiating those contracts. And so having competent people to negotiate those contracts and get, you know, learn from other people's failures. We can learn off of money that other states and provinces have lost doing, you know, we can look at whatever, everything that's been done through NCSL, the state, I mean, the USDOT, there's a lot of sources, and we can try to learn from those examples and incorporate that. And then, you know, trying to create a regional marketplace so we'll have more scale, we'll get more parties interested, we'll have more bidders, and have a more robust competition, because at the end of the day, competition is what's going to drive prices down.
is important. And then the last one I mentioned about demonstrating the money's being well spent. So that's what I had to say. I know you guys have been here for a long time, so I wanted to keep it brief. I hope it wasn't too general. I'm happy to answer any other questions. And thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
This is fascinating information and a lot to contemplate. The key from my standpoint in getting this started is this whole, we keep talking about improving outcomes. Mm-hmm. And it's nice that we have examples from other areas, but when we're talking in Oregon, sometimes those examples are harder to apply. And so while I can appreciate and look at the projections and what where we may save through innovation, that a lot of that isn't going to be known for years. So we're going to make an argument that part of what we're going to do is improve the outcomes. And so for me, it's this, how are we going to quantify early on that discussion about improving outcomes so that the investors and others, I mean, bring that together?
Sure. I think there's a couple of, Chairman Reed, members of the committee, I don't want to do all that. Representative Lively, a couple of things. I think, first of all, one answer to your question is part of what these centers of expertise does, a significant portion of partnership species work, is the upfront analysis. And I submitted written testimony, which is even more boring than what I had to say. But if you have time to read it, you can. I included an attachment in there, which is an example of a business case analysis from partnership species. There's a screening study for the Multnomah County Courthouse, which is the first high level. Is this even worth talking about, or should we not go down this road? Then there's a full business case analysis. I just included the table of contents to give you a feel of what's in that. But they go through a rigorous analysis to say, okay, if we go do it, the status quo path, what's it going to cost? What are the risks that we're taking? What do we expect to get for that? And then they look at, on a project-by-project basis, what could be achieved through a different approach. And then they do a quantification of that. And oftentimes the conclusion is, especially on simple projects that are not that big, just go do it the way you've done it in the past. There's not a lot of benefits to this. And I agree with what Mr. Reed said about the scale of project. You're not going to do this for a $10 million rehab of a roof at a school. It's not going to make sense at all. You're just going to go trying to do that the way you've traditionally done it. So you need to have a rigorous analysis, and that will tell you what you can expect, and that will be based over time on they have enough experience that they can say, okay, we've done 4 highway projects, we've done 5 bridges, what did we get out of those? Now, Oregon would have to start by looking at examples from other places, which we're always a little loath to do, but that would be a starting point, is to look at what recent transactions in the market in other states or countries have yielded, and use that as a quantification of what the benefits would be. And there was a mention of public sector comparator. That's basically a fancy word for what would it cost to do it the traditional way, what we get for it, and then a value for money analysis is trying to figure out, would there be a benefit or not? And oftentimes, like I said, the answer is no, so you do it the traditional way. So I think that's part of the question. As far as how do you justify it to investors, I think investors are going to do their own analysis, right? They're going to, frankly, not rely a heck of a lot on what they're told. They're going to do their own diligence. They're going to have their own finance people, their own engineers, their own experts. And frankly, the people that bid on these things are good at this, and they've done it all over the world. And they will apply their own metrics. What they want to know, and I've gone out and met with dozens and dozens of these folks, including Ulico and some of the other people that were mentioned. And across the board, what they say is they want clarity and certainty. They want to know, what are the rules of the game? Is this project ultimately going to get approved? Because they're, just to give an example, they're what they call dead deal costs, the amount of money they spend to participate in a solicitation for a big project, could be on the order of $3 or $4 million. Mm-hmm. And they're okay with losing as long as somebody wins, but what they don't like is to have 5 of them each spend $3 million and nobody gets a contract. That makes people not want to come back to that jurisdiction for future deals. So I think, they will do their own analysis of whether it's a good idea, what their investment metrics are. And I think what John's talked about is really significant, that there are investors who, of course, have a fiduciary responsibility to their retirees to get a good, a reasonable rate of return. But that rate of return is predicated on the risk, right? It's a risk-adjusted rate of return. And U.S. infrastructure, this is a shocking commentary, but I attended a meeting with most of the big heavy hitters in infrastructure investment
in North America in New York a few months ago, and these were largely Canadian pension funds and some U.S. funds like TIA, CRAF, and others, and they said that they ranked the U.S. right above India as an infrastructure investment climate, below Chile, below Thailand, below a whole bunch of countries that most of us Americans would like to think of as developing countries. It has just not been a very transparent, simple road in the U.S., and if people perceive that there's political stability behind these deals and that there's lower risk, which there should be, these should not be high-risk assets, then the rate of return they're going to expect to earn will be lower. I hope that resonates.
Right, right.
That's really part of the game, is demonstrating this is a low-risk. A 30-year asset with a mid-single-digit return is actually a pretty good deal for a pension fund. But historically, they've been targeting, you know, higher in the teens rates of returns because it was considered really risky. It was like in the same category as leveraged buyouts.
So just for the benefit of the committee and anyone else who's interested, all the stuff that you talked about in terms of the table of contents analysis and all that sort of stuff is available on OLIS. Mm-hmm. Anybody wants to read or review it.
And so the other question, and maybe there's not an answer, I'm just trying to understand timing of this, because we talk about risk and we also talk about a surety for the investors. And so sometimes when the project gets elongated or the timing gets elongated, you get more risk from the standpoint of other parties entering in. So I'm trying to understand the timing it takes for this kind of deal to do this from kind of start to finish versus what would be the standard project.
I did include in my written testimony, there's a graph in there that shows that, you know, it's a timeline from Partnerships BC of what their process looks like, how long it takes to do each step of the process. And the short answer is, for a big complex project like a big new building or a giant transportation project with hundreds of millions or $1 billion type budget, that's going to be probably 18 months start to finish of analysis, development of the criteria, putting it out to bid, negotiating, et cetera. For something that's smaller, of course, it can be shorter. And how that compares with the traditional, it probably adds some amount of time, but the difference would be that instead of spending time up front designing and coming up with blueprints, you're coming up with performance specifications. So you probably save some time on the design, but you're going to have a more protracted negotiation period and a little more analysis. But that, I'd refer you to that graph that's in the body of my written testimony that breaks it out sort of based on real experience from Canada of how long each piece takes.
Questions? Comments? It's fascinating to me, too. I appreciate the update, and as you said, we have a task force looking into this a little further. Representative Benson and I are your representatives there, so we're eager to hear if you have particular concerns or questions. There'll be open meetings, I assume, and anybody who wants to be part of that certainly can be. Our charge is to come back with recommendations in 2014, so we'll keep you apprised of that and come back with some recommendations. I think that completes our agenda. We really appreciate you guys being here. Exciting to me to think about what's possible going forward. So it was the informational meeting. And one other thing before we adjourn for today is to remind all of you that we have a short session in 2014. That doesn't come as a surprise to you. Each individual legislator has two bills you can introduce, and the committees each have three. So as you are developing your proposals, please remember that if they happen to be relevant to this committee, we have November and January meetings at which you might want to explore or discuss your proposals in a public session or public setting like this. And further, if you have ideas that the committee should consider for introduction as committee measures, I'd very much like to hear about those. So let us know. We do have those opportunities in November and January. We haven't set our agendas yet. Some ideas emerging, but there's capacity if you have particular ideas you want to discuss. Anything else to come before the committee today?
Okay. Thank you.
Ready? We're going to adjourn? We're adjourned. Thank you.